All right, what's going on? Thanks for coming in and checking out another episode of Happy Hour. We got the boys back. Me, Mason Kleinsmith, Sean Corbett, True West Realty Group, and it should be a good one today. So how you guys doing? How was y'all's weekend?
Doing all right. Got back from a wedding. Feeling refreshed today.
Yeah? How was the wedding?
Pretty good. It was in St. Louis, Missouri. So had a good time out there with my cousin, dad, and my wife. It's a good weekend. Quick turnaround. You know, normally don't get too many chances to have a day in a different country or different city I haven't been in. So it was fun.
There you go.
What about you, Sean?
It's probably one of the slowest weekends I've had in a long time, for sure. All we had was a soccer game and, you know, we just did the normal chores, getting set up for the next week. So getting everyone prepped. It was pretty low-key.
Nice. Slow weekends can be nice sometimes, just getting your life back in order.
Yeah, it's hard to have anything slow. We've got three kids under eight, so they keep us pretty busy for sure.
Well, getting lives back in order, that's the last thing I did this weekend. my buddy got married a couple weeks ago. So for his wedding gift, I figured I'd take him out to it's a place called Oak and Eden out in Bridgeport. It actually is some of my favorite whiskey out there. And they do this thing where you can go customize a bottle of whiskey. So he likes whiskey. I like whiskey. So we went and did a little, it was like a tasting. I didn't even know there would be a tasting. So we show up and we're back there making this bottle, right? And he pulls out these flights. They're kind of like flights, I guess. And it was all, you know, it was the wheat and rye or just, it was the different types of whiskey they had. So we're trying it. And when we get out there, so it was just me and him tasting it. Right. So I go, like, we're grabbing him and kind of as he's talking and I just, you know, shoot it. I thought that's what we were doing.
And the guy, whiskey tasting? Come on.
I've never tasted whiskey before, man. So I do it. And then the guy looks at me and he goes, "You just offended me." And I was like, "Oh, I didn't even know what I did." You know what I mean? So, long story short, you're not supposed to shoot it. You're supposed to take a little sip and go side to side. And there's this whole spill about how we're not here to take shots of whiskey, all this kind of stuff. So, long story short, kind of kept getting some slap on the hands that night. And, we worked it out. We resolved it. We left on civil terms, but it was a fun experience. But apparently if y'all go taste whiskey, taste it. Don't shoot it. So that was my weekend.
It was the don't call us and don't come back, but we're in good terms.
Yeah. No, they made it right. I did kind of like mention, I kind of mentioned how I was uneasy about it and they ended up like comping my drinks and stuff like that. So we were cordial. but speaking of intimidation a little bit, YouTube. So shout out Sneeko. I really like Sneeko and he makes a lot of kind of controversial topics. And he posted, this is what made me think about it, is there's so many people, and we've talked about this on previous episodes, that there's so many people that are getting banned from YouTube and TikTok and all these platforms for violations of their policies. Well, I'm reading the fine print of it. And on that fine print, it says that intimidation is a violation of YouTube policy. So to me, when I'm reading that, that's a very relative term, right? Like we could have conversations with people and it happens all the time. Even with our example at the whiskey distillery, someone was offended, other people were not offended. And it's more about how someone receives the message or the words or the actions that you're doing. So for me, YouTube, how do you measure intimidation? The definition of timid is to be lack of courage or not speaking up when in certain situations that where you're rubbed the wrong way. So what are y'all's thoughts on that?
I can chime in a little bit here. So it's kind of like the line of when a victim is offended. That's kind of where you usually start with these type of things. They're the ones that initiate a claim or have issue. You know, in that line used to be at a point where they were probably hurt. But now that hurt has been moved and blurred so much that just saying something makes them offended. And that line is starting to get a lot more blurred. Mm-hmm. You know, it's part of that cancel culture thought process. You know, I'm offended. I don't want to see your product or things. And I want everybody else to agree with me because of how offended I was.
Yeah.
You know, that line has really come a lot closer to, you know, being gray or impossible to define.
Yeah, it's still ambiguous. It is the problem. And that ambiguity is different for each person. That gray line is different for each person. So it's hard to measure that.
Yeah, I agree. And there's so many times in real life where, you know, and I can sometimes, I guess, be a little confrontational, or I don't shy away from confrontation. Like, I like getting to a resolution and having an open conversation. And there's been so many times where, even in my personal life, something has bugged, the actions of another person have bugged me. I directly bring it up to somebody as a question. What was the full story here, so that I can, you know, see your side of the story? And just asking that question, people will say, like, hey, that was a bit aggressive. And in my head, I'm like, that wasn't aggressive. I just asked a question, you know? So I don't like that being a something that can be a term that can be violated, because it's just too loose. I mean, you, no matter what you say, I made a video, and it was about why I switched from car sales to real estate. And somehow people didn't like that. Like, that wasn't even a controversial message, but it you know, the type of cars you're selling, like, it just was not taken the way that it was supposed to be taken. So it's like, no matter what you post or say, someone's going to be on the other side of that. So I think that's something that could be
expected, right? I mean, that's kind of part of why we share and say things, because we're going to have pushback on our thoughts and things. That's okay. I mean, that's fine, but it's where they take that and they make it a personal issue. And then they want to take further action on something that is just an opinion.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I think a lot of times it gets, you know, out of hand.
I agree. Do you have anything else to add in on that?
Yeah, it's just that gray line. I'm offended. I think you should take it down a couple notches, eight to six, Wes. You know, you got to appease the masses out there that have soft skin.
The world we live in, man. All right. So, speaking of controversial, it's been a bit of a tough year for the LGBTQT community. Slightly. First, we had monkeypox making the headlines. Now we got the face of the transgender community, Jamie Lee Henry, first Army official, openly transgender Army official,
military officer.
Right headline? Apparently, it was selling data on healthcare data from our soldiers to Russia. It may not have just been the soldiers, but they're leaking private data to the Russians. And I have a few notes. Let me pull them up. So the husband and wife were both convicted on conspiracy. And basically, so one's the Jamie Lee Henry, former Army major. He's a doctor at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And on August 17th, Gabby is his wife. And he does identify as he, him. That is actually in the legal court documents. So those are correct pronouns. August 17th, Gabby, the wife, agreed to meet with an undercover Russian agent. So basically what she said was, we are committed to helping Russia. They were motivated by patriotism towards Russia and wanted to provide any assistance she could to Russia, even if it meant losing her job or going to jail. Gabby said, and then that's when Gabby kind of wheeled in. I will be fair. The wife is the one that reeled in the husband, from what I've come to understand, saying that he would be more beneficial to the Russian parties than she would, because he has more access to the health data. So long story short, they both were just all in, willing and committed to helping Russia. And I'll kind of slow it down here, but I don't know the specifics, but they didn't like the way that they felt like US was using the Ukrainian people against in this whole Russia Ukraine conflict. Again, I didn't do enough research on that part, but what do y'all think of that? I mean, I think, and I'll be honest too, right? Because my full opinion on this is just that, obviously, the only part about the transgender part that just brings in more views and headlines, that, like, obviously being transgender has no correlation to that violation, but it makes a great headline, a lot of clicks. So
you think we're getting more clicks because this spy was transgender than
if that was otherwise. Just a spy? Yes, definitely getting more publicity because they're transgender. Agree or disagree?
Probably agree with that.
It makes it controversial, even though there's no like...
Yeah, relevance there.
Yeah.
There could be, right? I mean, you have, you know, and I don't have any scientific data or anything to describe this, but, you know, they may be more having a propensity to lead with their emotion and things versus being a lot more objective. And they took feelings and emotions on how they felt about the Ukrainians to make a very consequential decision against the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, if I were them, though, I mean, Russia's broke, right? Why wouldn't they go to China or someone that's got some money? They're not in the middle of a war conflict. They'd have made more money if they went somewhere else. You know, I know that's totally off topic, but that's you know, they're opportunistic. Maybe it's not as beneficial. They could have made more money.
And that's what we're, that's what was weird to me too, was just like, why, what's, where's the loyalty to Russia coming in? Like, why so loyal to Russia versus other ways? And maybe it's because they came to them first, right?
Well, like, no, they took the Ukrainians' side, is in a sense, like, not the Ukrainian side. They did not like the way the Ukrainians were doing things, so they took the Russian side against the Ukrainians in that sense.
Yeah,
which is still all ridiculous.
Well, and just to be, I guess, to be more clear, I think it was more, I think they're, the way they went about it was more against the states. I don't think it was more like, the way I read it, it wasn't pro Russia or Ukraine. It was more just against the way that we're handling the situation in general. Okay. So, but I mean, if we're doing any, from my perspective, I mean, everything I've read, and I could be reading garbage, but it just, everything I've read is we're giving a lot of support to Ukraine. Right. I mean,
I'd like to think it wasn't because that they were pro Russian more so than it was just the money that they were being paid.
Yeah.
I think a person like that, whenever you are willingly committing treason, it's going to the highest bidder. It's not because that their allegiance is with one country or another, or they don't like what the U.S. is doing. They just got paid enough to push information that shouldn't have been pushed.
I agree. But also the other part of that is whenever they had that call with the undercover, they are like, it just, it's strange to me how committed this, like, I'm willing to lose my job and go to jail for my commitment to your country. Like,
at some point you have to make the decision, how far do I go to absolve myself or face consequences? The consequence worth treason or whatever it is, right? Yeah,
you got to be feeling dumb too. Like, you know, just like when you realize that you're that open and willing to do that, and then you find out that was an undercover. Could you imagine?
Well, now their lives are ruined.
Oh yeah 100%.
Husband and wife, they're one and the same in that case.
Yeah
Just for the clicks, they were transgender, by the way.
Yeah, transgender. All right, so moving on, we had Hurricane Ian. So they've been saying the death toll has been rising, and here's the interesting, I mean, we all know what's going on. Big hurricane hit out there in Florida, but was it Lee County?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that was part of the county.
Part of the county.
Number of counties.
So it's the numbers vary.
Lee County is the one on the edge, so it is on the border or the on the coast. So that's why it's relevant.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Lee County, this is the very interesting part. So apparently, there's been about 60 at this point. It's gone up a couple billion, like, the past couple of days I've been checking it. But right now, the current damage they're estimating that was done was $65 billion in damage, and only 28% of homeowners in Lee County had flood insurance. And they're saying that, I think what they're saying is the further as you get away from that coast, that it may not necessarily be required. And those homeowners may believe that there can be hurricane policies.
Yeah, the neighboring county was at 5%.
Yeah. Right?
And there's relevant reason, you know, for if you live in an area that's not saturated within the 100-year floodplain, there's not any sense getting flood insurance, but you could, and it's cheap. Mm-hmm. Being on the coast, it's outrageously expensive. So I know that's one of the barriers to entry. But I felt, we were kind of talking through this, you know, I think a lot of those homeowners or vacation homeowners, they pay cash. And if you do not have a loan, you don't have to, it's up to you if you want to get insurance or not. You know, I know Mason's working in as a lender, and he's going to require flood insurance if you're in the HUD in your floodplain, and they have other restrictions and rules, and it's a lot more expensive. I can't even imagine it'd be 10 times as much probably living on the coast, because you know you're inevitably going to hit with something that's going to cause substantial damage.
Yeah, and part of the reason they were saying a lot of them don't have it is because they believe that it's covered by certain hurricane policies that they're not covered by. So it's, you know, one thing, Biden coming through with some more aid, you know, some aid to them. But the problem with that is that they're not just going to be dishing out money for everyone that didn't have that flood insurance. It's going to be going towards homes that need minor repairs and things of that sort. So, and maybe like renovations or something, like, not for total losses. So what people, my concern in that, on rebuilding the economy out there in Florida, is that that's going to delay that process, because there's going to be a lot of people waiting in line to hopefully get those benefits. And then when maybe the inspector or the whoever's coming out to do that qualification comes out, I think that's going to disqualify a lot of people and push back that rebuilding process.
Can I introduce a controversial topic here?
Please.
If you like them. Yeah, like
controversial topics. 6 to 20.
This goes back. This goes back to way back when the country was established. Daniel Boone, right? Do you all remember the guy? He was a frontier. He was out there. He was going around looking to collect votes because he ran for Congress. And he was collecting votes. He went across a gentleman who said that he wouldn't vote for him. And he said, well, why wouldn't you vote for him? This is just like a second term. He said, well, the first term, you voted to rebuild a local house because it was devastated by some type of natural disaster. You voted for it. And he said, the problem is you voted for something that was never your money. Mm-hmm. And that's where we have a challenge. Like, even for us, is the right thing to send money to the Ukrainians because of the way it affects us? Or is the right answer to come in and spend money to take care of people on natural disasters? I don't have the answer to that, but we are spending money that's not ours to do things that have nothing to do to benefit the natural, the existence of our taxpayers, right? So we're all collecting all this money and they're spending on our behalf and voting for things that do nothing to benefit us as the taxpayers.
And that another example of that too is with the immigration policies, when now that they're putting people out to go to, you know, New York and these other places, these people in New York aren't happy with it. And I don't misquote me. I think it was Nancy Pelosi. Is that her name?
Pelosi.
She said something that was just wild. So imagine, and she said that like basically that Florida should consider keeping a lot of those people because she said that local farmers said they need those immigrants to, you know, keep working the crops. It's just like, who said that, you know? So local farmers. Well, like, imagine if that was like Trump saying that or someone on the other side. Yeah, it would be Nancy, hell would break loose.
She can't be racist. She can't be.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, she can't be. So she can say that.
Yeah. But you're in the mortgage industry. What are your thoughts on the flood stuff going on in the homeowners affected by it?
Whenever you came out with those statistics about the actual flood insurance and that, what was it, over 3/4 basically don't have flood insurance. That's amazing to me. Yeah. I can't imagine being a lender, making a mortgage on a property. I mean, it is required that these homes that we make loans on have flood insurance. Mm-hmm. I look for flood zone X on the flood certs that we order. If it doesn't have flood zone X, there's a lot of things that lenders have to do to make sure that that borrower is going to be able to afford that flood insurance in addition to their normal home payments.
Yeah. What's your follow up, right? I mean, you get a loan, you got to have one initially, but initially they may let the policy lapse.
Right.
Now they'll keep insurance, but they may drop that particular component in their insurance.
Right.
How do you know?
When that property's refinanced, it goes to a different lender. Say they pay that loan off and that flood policy expires, they don't have to renew it. And at that point, that's on the borrower.
So there are gaps in getting flood insurance, and a lot of them have been through these natural disasters and the government comes in and writes checks and they all think that that's the solution.
Right. And so there are other avenues where people think that they can get around having flood insurance, whether it expires, they think they can pay for it themselves. It's never going to happen. There's federal subsidies out there that allow people to borrow very, very cheaply to make home repairs. But whenever you have a complete loss of your property, if really flood insurance is the only sure way to get that property covered.
Yeah.
And most people, I don't think, realize that, even living on the coast, apparently not, based on the statistics that you said. Scary.
Yeah. And that's what blew my mind too. Like what you're saying is just that specific demographic is going to be impacted by it the most. So that there's such a shortage of people having it is just strikes me as odd.
Right.
So you know, what's crazy to me is like, I'm a high risk taker, right? I flipped a lot of houses. Not everyone's got the stomach to buy and renovate and then resell a property for profit because a lot of risk involved in it. So I'm willing to take a lot of risk. And the reason I don't build or do VRBOs and things on the coast is because of the salt water, because it destroys everything, because the cost of renovating and keeping that house up to date is crazy expensive. But I wouldn't have even had a thought of not getting some type of hurricane or flood insurance. It does surprise me. 28 is a ridiculously low number.
Yeah.
And there may be something that they're taking from that we're not getting the full picture, but that's a crazy low number.
My question is, and I don't know how it works specifically, but like if you hear, like I'm on the news, I live in Florida, I got a place on the coast, I don't have flood insurance. And then I read the news and it says, Hurricane Ian's coming in hot.
Yeah, get on the phone.
Can you not just go get a policy? Like, what? Yeah. Like, at that point, like, what, do you double down?
Or yeah,
you
just like $200 a day, something. Right. You're about to lose, you know, $1 million.
The first call I made. Like,
yeah, some of these videos that they were coming out, I'm sure most people have seen them by now, but the time lapses of the actual water coming in to some of these beaches and coastal towns, I mean, it's 1 foot of water over a sidewalk in 1 minute, and then the next 30 minutes you've got 15 feet of water knocking over the palm trees, like all your telephone lines are down, no power.
Like ant farm. That actually brings the other point that actually is a good topic, is the people, I forget who's supposed to be reporting that, but the people who are supposed to give that evacuation order are getting a lot of controversy right now. They're getting a lot of heat because everyone's like, well, y'all didn't give us enough of a notice to evacuate. But they're saying that, and most people are siding with the people giving that executive order because they're like, well, it just kind of came unpredicted. It wasn't, it did kind of come as it hit, it changed directions and came out of nowhere.
Everyone's always going to point the finger at somebody else.
Yeah. And recently,
lack of accountability. I mean, I knew to get out of the state.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here in, Flower Mound, Texas.
Yeah. And there were some very funny TikToks about conservatives holding the Trump signs and stuff. And they're just like in the wind. they're actually pretty funny. But yeah. Any, y'all have anything else to throw into that?
It's just sad.
It is. Yeah. Prayers go out.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
Yeah, did he have flood insurance at Mar-a-Lago?
I'm sure he did.
Is that on the east side?
You know he came out the upper hand on that one.
Yeah, he worked out a deal. He made some money on it.
Flooded those documents. So
what documents?
He's probably wishing it came a month sooner. So another one, we had Kim Kardashian getting sued for a little over $1.25 million.
Yeah, this hits on a couple different topics that we've talked about previously, too.
Yeah.
I mean, just freedom of these social media companies to cancel and sue and determine what they think is right versus not right. And we've talked about that before.
Except Kim K, she's not cancelable.
Yeah, she's too big to be cancelable. So there's a line there. You get too big and you can't be canceled.
Yeah.
Too small, you can't be canceled, or too big, you can't be canceled.
Or too much influence in a certain, maybe political way, maybe you can't be canceled. But I don't know. I've told you before, I'm pretty off limits on what Facebook does with their deal. I mean,
yeah,
it's not the government. They're an independent, capitalistic. They make money by people getting on and advertisers paying money. And
well, and here's the kicker, right? So
they're not a neutral platform for us to post things.
My boy Steve will do it. Got, and we called this. We saw this coming. Steve will do it here, and I'm gonna give me like 2 minutes. I'm gonna paint the bigger picture. Nelk, we can say Kardashians as well. These are both influencers that aren't just influencers. They have multiple successful brands, and I would argue, I don't know, I've never bought any of Kim K's products, but like, I respect the products that Nelk and Steve will do it has put out. They're the merch and all the, the supplements, and they got the Happy Dads. I mean, they have quality products.
These people build trust with their customer base and the people that
big bags for that. They're making a lot of money on their own, promoting their own product. And same with Kim Kardashian. So what Kim Kardashian got sued for was for promoting a cryptocurrency, and her violation was she didn't disclose the $250,000 she was making for the post to promote that. Now, Steve Will Do It got canceled taken down from YouTube because he had been promoting steak, which we said, not a good idea. We said that on episode 2.
Mm-hmm.
So go watch it. It's still up on the channel. But the reason he got taken down and banned was because you can talk about gambling, you can promote it, but you can't put www.xgamblingsite.com. You can't link the website. So they took down, he had 5 million subscribers. Most of his videos are him giving out money to people. Like, it has a net positive effect, I would argue, on society. But because he put that .com on the gambling site, done. So Kim K is, again, now I don't, and that term may not violate that policy for the social media sites versus the actual SEC laws, but she's getting sued for not disclaiming that she is making $250,000. So she's getting sued for that amount plus interest plus $1 million in penalty.
So this is just a drop in the bucket for Kim K.
Yeah.
There's, and the thing that gets me is the damages that she's paying in fines is dwarfed in comparison to the product that she pushed and how much say it is a bad product that actually goes out and that there are security problems with this crypto that she was pushing, the damages that can come from these people buying whatever product that they push and not really knowing what it is, not knowing the details about it, but they're just getting a check. See, that's a problem. And the people that buy and bought that crypto, I guarantee it's a lot more than the fine that she's been paid, right?
100%. But that's not the rule of these fines, right? They're not here to, bring justice to people who were screwed over. They're here to make an example of people that violate their terms. So that's, you know, not I'm not out here wishing that Kim K got sued for more money. You know what I mean? It's just the logic behind it is, you're right, it just is kind of doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, all in all, I think it's still a good thing that the SEC is out there watching people's backs. We got to have somebody looking out for us. And if that means that the SEC is the person doing it, I guess more power to them.
Yeah.
How far are they going to push it, though? Who knows?
Yeah. So what do you got? You were talking about this pipeline.
Yeah.
Bring it up, man. Let's hear it.
Circling back to Russia and the Ukraine war. Ukraine has actually been doing better, pushing back into their formerly captured territory. So that's, I think, great news for the U.S. and its allies and the Ukraine and the Ukraine people. But off of that, there's been a recent development on the Nordstrom pipeline that was just quote-unquote sabotage. They don't have it. Investigations ongoing. And no answers yet. That's
Russia's pipeline.
So this was a pipeline going from Russia to Europe and feeding Europe natural gas supplies. It's going to be a cold winter in Europe because of this war that's going on and now this pipeline that's been blown up. Now, a few months ago, the U.S. government came out and said, and I think Biden specifically said that, and was threatening Europe to stop importing natural gas reserves from Russia. And basically said, if they don't stop, then we will force you to stop. And now this incident has happened that's caused a lot of people to point back at the United States with a little bit of, with an eyebrow raised. You know, yeah. who benefits from this pipeline going out? Obviously, it's not going to benefit Europe or the people in Ukraine that were relying on these energy reserves. Monetarily, it's going to benefit the people who are now sending our natural gas reserves to Europe. It's going to be profiting the United States and Canada and the reserves that now Europe is importing from us instead of Russia.
And now Biden's lack of memory finally benefits him because he doesn't remember saying that.
I never said anything like that.
My good patriotic mindset thinks, all right, it wasn't the U.S. This is just another conspiracy out there. But it really is interesting to think about the repercussions that just these small events in the grand scheme of things can have. I mean, the tensions, I think, in Ukraine and Russia, it's a giant proxy war that's probably won't stop anytime soon.
Yeah.
Just the latest on it.
I've got one more question. And then I know you had another topic you wanted to bring up. Maybe it does have something to do with it, but a lot of people I've been talking to in real life have been wondering, you know, you think Putin's going to actually drop a nuke if it comes to it? And I'm 50-50. I feel like, you know, would he just take people out with him? You know, like what do y'all think he'd go?
Depends on how suicidal he is. Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Well, we always talk about giving him a way out, right? And if you give him a way out, he won't.
Right.
But if he puts his back against the wall. If he can't save face, mm-hmm. then he's forced to make bad decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, that's always the case. I think anytime you're in conflict like this, that's why this isn't going to end anytime soon. And Ukrainian's not going to give up. So what do you do to stimulate and do this? And there are, you know, a lot of levels before, you know, a high level nuke before that has to happen that are still nuclear type options. Mm-hmm. Could he do any of those? I mean, sure, all things are going to be on the table for him.
Yeah.
But the consequences and the ramifications, you know, are so dramatic. I don't see it happening.
Yeah.
I just don't.
Well, I don't even know if I want to call it an upside, but the only upside we would experience that, you know, God forbid we get hit by one of those nukes, is that obviously a lot of the allies that we have lost that now Russia kind of has, I feel like we would probably get some of them back because, like, you know, Putin, that's a little
everyone
far.
Everyone would turn on Russia if they did that. Yes.
Yeah.
I think China would stay out. they probably won't have an opinion, which is the way they like to play it. But for sure, I mean, anytime that happens, everyone would be out on their support for sure.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Do it.
I don't think we're getting nuked. I don't think Russia's dumb enough to drop nukes. I think if it was, it would be a very, very bad situation and definitely the start of World War III, if that was the point. That would take us from a proxy war in Ukraine where we're fighting over oil and gas reserves currently to really the next level. But I don't think we're there yet.
What do you think it would look like today if Trump were still president? Do you think Russia would be invading Ukraine?
Absolutely not.
Well, I agree with you. There's absolutely no way he's invading Ukraine. He watched the way he dealt with Iran, Iraq, North Korea, all way escalated.
Yeah.
And he de-escalated all of it. And those just weren't all coincidental. I mean, they know that if he says he's going to do something, they didn't want to take a chance because he's bombastic.
Right.
Right. I mean, they just did not want to take a chance.
Yeah.
And well, dude, he got into it with Putin too, several times.
Yeah.
There was escalation and nothing happened. Nothing came of it.
And he was criticized for just being around him.
Yeah.
You know,
like, well, he said good things about Putin. Trump did.
As you should with a leader with kind of nuclear capabilities that has an ego. You know, you got to know who you're dealing with, right? Like,
that is a really interesting conversation to have. Looking back at the prior elections, and now that it's been, I guess, proven, I'll leave that in some quotation marks there, that Russia had interfered with the election in support of Trump. So obviously, in their mind,
he did call a North Korean leader Rocket Kim.
Yeah.
But keep going. I'll tell you, I love Trump. I just love it. He'll say things you're not supposed to say.
In Russia's mind, they were looking at Trump like he is going to be the better president. Maybe their idea is that he would have avoided the war.
Who did Biden vote for? Right? How about that? Did he vote for? Or not Biden? I'm sorry, Putin. Obviously can't vote, but who would he vote for, Biden or Trump? What do you think?
I'd say Biden.
Yes, total control.
Right? Yeah.
He got exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to reach out and take back.
That's a good perspective. I've never thought of that.
I don't know if Putin's pushing Biden. I think the proven, quote unquote, in the election interference from what they've said, but they were supporting Trump. So why would Putin go and interfere with the U.S. elections to push someone that's more difficult?
I think that's harder. I think it's the irony. Like that's why I think all of that's total nonsense. Russia didn't have anything to do with the election. This is the irony.
Yeah.
Right? Because no, he would not absolutely go for Trump.
You think that Trump would be more difficult than Biden would be in this war?
This is not even a question.
Yeah.
Like even if Trump would never even counterattack in a nuclear, he would sure make you think he would.
Right.
Right? I mean, he just would.
Yeah.
And just because you'd be fair, you wouldn't know what to expect. And he bowed up against all the other world leaders and most of them came down. And he even met with them at a point where he was able to save face with them. That's part of that negotiating, right? I mean, you've got to give them the ability to save face. But he might call them out publicly, but he created a way for Kim to back down and stop being so obnoxious.
Been reading 48 Laws of Power, and it's Robert Greene. Hit him with an iron fist, but a velvet glove. That's, you know. Anyways, I know you got another topic. Do you want to bring it up, transition it? Yes,
yeah, the last one, bringing it back to the U.S. internally here. There is a Federal Reserve emergency meeting scheduled today. I think it's actually going on as we have this conversation, October the 3rd.
You said monthly they have an emergency meeting, right?
Yeah, just about.
Is it considered emergency if it's every month?
That's the thing. They call it an emergency meeting.
Podcast emergency meeting.
Yeah, they call it an emergency meeting, but it's not necessarily an emergency. These things are more standard. It would be really interesting to be a fly on the wall.
It's an emergency to the media because it creates news.
Yes.
It creates news.
Anything to get clicks. And in this meeting, they're discussing where the Federal Reserve rate is and what they expect. From what I've heard, throughout the rest of this year, we're probably going to expect another 150 basis point hike in the federal funds rate.
Which where are we at, where are we expected
today? Just as far as like 30-year interest rate on a purchase term, we're looking at 6%. Okay. I mean, it's getting up there, and it really has been amazing. So they're saying
7.5?
Well, see, it's not, the thing is, that's a common misconception. The federal funds rate isn't directly tied to your everyday mortgage rates, right? While a lot of times they work together. We've seen the Fed go in and increase 75 basis points on a hike, but we saw mortgage bonds improve that week. Prices actually reacted positively to the Fed having a tough reaction and increasing rates as much as they have. That being said, over the long term, yeah, you expect those mortgage rates to increase with the federal funds rate, though. Even though if it's not immediately, you generally expect them to move together. So, yeah, I don't think we're seeing interest rate relief anytime soon, especially not through the end of this year. One of the big conversations I've had to have with a lot of my customers recently and people who are buying homes is buying down rates or not, which is a whole discussion in itself that I think we've touched around on previous podcasts. But I'll pose a question to both of you guys here. If you were in a borrowing situation where you're going to buy a house right now, you have the option to buy down your interest rate. Right now, I mean, you're looking at a 6.5% rate to buy a home, or say you refinance a property. Would you buy that rate down today? Say you wanted to spend $5,000 to get your 6.5 rate down to 5.5. Now, would you go ahead and take that thinking that you are not going to pay off your loan and you're going to keep that loan? Or do you go into that thinking that rates in the next 2 years are going to normalize, we're going to get back down into 4%, and then at that point, you're just going to go in and refinance? So really, one side or the other, buy down the rate, keep your term, or do you think interest rates in the next 2 years are going to decrease to a point where you're just going to refi that same loan?
I'll let you open that one up.
Yeah, 6% is not high.
So you're saying
it's normal.
Buy down and keep the loan for the term.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that now. We've gone 10 years, right, or 5 years, a solid 5 years of rates that have been ridiculously low. That's not normal. 6% is a normal mortgage loan.
Right.
You know, over the history of owning homes. So I guess I look at it a little bit more globally, or you know, everything's negotiable to me. I'd probably make the seller buy down the loan for me. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Like to them, they don't see the net as the same way I see the net. Mm-hmm. And I negotiate all the time. I do this all the time. They only care about sales price. I'll say, you know, I'll give you your sales price, buy down my note $5,000. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not out of pocket anything. There's always a way to make it so it comes across, everybody wins. You know, that I would do that anyway. If I knew that I was paying a higher interest rate. But the walk away though is, even if, you know, my rate's still 6 or 6.5 and I feel like that makes it less affordable, I mean, there's always the opportunity to refinance if it does. If it doesn't, leave it alone. We're winning.
Yeah.
Either way, you're going to win. Either you don't refinance because the rates go up, or you do refinance because the rates go down.
Yeah.
What's the difference? I now own real estate that's making me money.
Yeah. So for me, ideal situation, I would, like, I'm buying tomorrow. What I would do, I would go to if I'm just talking about a single family home, I would go to a builder who has those connections that have their built-in lender with them, to where they would offer me a lower interest rate than what that average is, because those are out there. So I would do that initially. And also I went to one at Shattuck Homes out there at Lakes of Argyle, and they're offering, it was $25,000 towards closing costs. You can use that to buy the rate down if you want to, but they're also offering a free refinance later down the road. That's one example of what builders are offering. So personally, no, I wouldn't buy it down. And also, like, even in that same scenario, right, I'm still, rates are 6%, 8%, 9%. I'm still not going to be looking at homes that are going to be outside of my budget. If 300, 400 bucks is going to make me broke, then I'm not buying that anyways. But if, as long as it's within the budget and I can make those payments, and that money I'd use to buy a property down, I would just use, and I'd put it towards stocks or another investment where I can just make that money appreciate either way. You know what I mean? So that would be my take on it. But I know also too, a lot of people don't really think like that. So
I would like to think that over the next 2 years, interest rates will normalize back to a more reasonable level.
What's reasonable?
Yeah. And that's a good question.
I'd say back to 4%.
No.
And that's where I'd say refinances are worth it. I'll ask the question to my bar, say four. Cause that'd make it worth it for someone who has a 6% loan today to refinance.
Yeah. 1.5+ before you refi.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so,
what I would say to back you a little bit on that, when you're, you know, cause yes, 6% is normal historically, but the way homes have appreciated, that impact of that 6% does hit a bit different, right? Cause that 6% on a 500,000 is different.
It's funny, before we've had everything. We've had low interest and crazy appreciation.
So
the money on real estate that I've made in the last few years is unbelievable, just because of those two things.
Yep.
And I mean, what are your thoughts though? Because like we can't moving forward, right? If homes continue to appreciate the way they have been, we can't always just refer to a historic rate as those prices come up and it makes them much bigger.
Mason's right in the sense that, you know, you can have optimism at a lower rate, and 4% may be what we see as a typical 30-year note going forward. I mean, it may just be.
Yeah.
It just over the history of 30-year notes, that's not been.
Yeah. Right.
It just hasn't.
So I have a question for you. What's the highest interest rate that you paid? And I'm assuming it may have been back in the 80s, 90s when rates were highest, because they've been coming down pretty steadily over the last three decades. Sure. To the point where we were at just 6 months ago, where I mean, my own interest rate is at 2.25% on my house. And I got in at the lowest of the low.
Yeah, that's about as low as you
and,
can get.
And so, but say in the 80s, what was the highest rate that you got?
So in the 80s, when I was in elementary school working my job buying houses,
90s.
I'm not that old. I graduated high school.
Putting you on blast here.
In 97. So I'm not, I mean, I wouldn't buy houses in the 90s. But we all know that they were having those 15% and some insane rates back in the 80s, right? We all hear about that because they talk, you know, back at that fondly. Like, I'm so glad we're paying 8%. Mm-hmm. Like, it's about where your perspective is.
Yeah.
You know, we all think that, you know, 2 and 3s are normal, you know, but it's not.
Right? Yeah.
And that's, but we've been, it's even gone to this strategy. Like, we, it's never going to be lower. And then it goes up a little bit. And then it went lower, which was crazy. Like the last few years, like we thought even just before that, it was in the 4s and they were great. And we can, you could get in the 2s. The rate on my current, my homestead now, we rented our first house and then we bought our second house. And the rate on that was like in the 2s. Mm-hmm. And then I'm never, why would I pay it off? Like inflation, I'm making money on inflation on my house.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, if you can be 3.5 or under, it's almost like the opposite of Ramsey. Just don't pay it off because the bank is holding my money that I can use to leverage to do something else, which I do. And then I'll let them continue to hold the note and lose money on it versus, you know, me.
I like Dave Ramsey, and this is a whole topic for itself that we should probably address separately.
Yeah, he wants to put you out of business. Let me keep going.
But yeah, the whole idea to paying off your debt is good for a lot of people,
sure.
Right? But there is such a thing as good, cheap debt. And real estate is the best example of that in most cases.
For sure. Because it generally appreciates faster than you can pay on. The simple thing for that, I'll just say Ramsey in just a nutshell. He is speaking to the masses as if everyone were fifth grade.
Yeah. Right?
And if I taught everyone in fifth grade that don't ever take debt, pay everything in cash, then everyone would have a good, successful life. They may not be able to do as much because they never learn how to properly leverage.
Right.
But the wealthiest of people learn how to leverage money in an effective way. And Ramsey's not going to teach that, and that's okay. You know, mm-hmm. I appreciate that he gives that hard stance of debt is dumb. You know, owning credit cards is dumb, and he says all these things, and it's good wisdom to a fifth grader.
Well, and it's most fitting to the general public.
For sure.
Right.
It's consumable, and he's right.
Yeah.
It doesn't make him wrong. I just think you can make a lot more money learning how to leverage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, you're right, and I think there's a demographic that works for, and again, like, I'm not going to take his advice personally, but maybe I should in some areas, but I just think that for people that are looking to really grow big and scale big and make the kind of money they're looking for when they're watching finance videos, I don't know that he's that guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny you talk finance. Finance has to do with debt.
Right.
He's anti-finance,
yeah.
Which is funny.
Yeah. Fair.
You know, I have his total money makeover. We've got the one for kids, and we're teaching our kids how to make money. It's everything is cash in, cash out,
mm-hmm.
And so they put in the different buckets.
You tell them, like, after fifth grade, just stop listening to Ramsey.
No, I tell them, I said, you know, Alex, here's your first credit card. We're good now.
Yeah. Once you get that credit card, no more Ramsey.
The principal, and that's why I say fifth grade, right? It could be even a higher number. But the point is cash in, cash out. You've got to learn that before we can learn on how much can I expand on leverage. Because most people, it's real easy to over-leverage.
Yeah.
I mean, I've certainly been there.
Yeah, and what you choose to take debt on for makes all the difference. Like, are you using debt to buy consumer goods, or are you using it for assets? And maybe I don't watch enough Ramsey, but maybe that's something that I don't feel like he clarifies enough of.
He doesn't do it at all. He thinks the mortgage is stupid.
Mm-hmm. He really thinks that?
Yeah.
He thinks so I clearly don't watch enough Ramsey.
His objective is to pay everything off.
Is to not have
he
debt.
He does not say it that way, but he says, you know, first we're going to build up a rainy day fund, then we're going to put enough pay down, start doing the snowball effect, pay down all of our debts. And then at some point when they get on the radio and they scream, I'm debt free, it's after they've paid out their mortgage. Mm-hmm. Now you're free of all strings that attached to you. And that's that freedom, which is a really amazing feeling for them, right?
Yeah.
But then you're on a cash in, cash out basis and you can't really grow or expand. It's not a bad life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a little bit more adventurous.
Yeah. And I do like that message.
I take risks.
And I agree to a degree. I mean, there's just so many people that get high paying jobs and they've got to, they start getting the house, they get the cars, they get all these things to where they're just, you know, working to pay off things they buy to impress people they don't like.
I think almost everybody lives to what they can afford. Yeah, right. I mean, that's just the reality. That's why we don't do armed mortgages.
There's a lot of people living above the means, you know? I mean,
or beyond that. But I'm saying, like, living to what you afford, and let's say you had an armed mortgage, you're burying yourself when that rate goes up.
Yeah.
But no one has armed mortgages anymore.
Yeah.
You know, adjustable rate mortgages where they adjust based on the market. You know, they don't do those really anymore.
Yeah. The only people that are doing that are investors who are immediately turning around and paying that note off.
They're short-term loans.
Yep.
Yeah. Yes, because they know they have a quick exit.
Do we have any other current event news topics or should we move on to real estate, fully real estate?
What are you thinking? I'm sure there's a few other current events.
I'm sure there's plenty of controversial topics out there. I just didn't prepare enough for these. So I guess we'll move on to real estate. I know one question, Sean, that I get a lot from when we go out recruiting people to join EXP is that, you know, a lot of people are kind of turned off by the quote virtual broker, which I will throw some shade at EXP for a second because they don't advertise enough that we do have Regis and spaces that we can go work out of. But when you hear at face value, you don't have an office, a brick and mortar place you can go work out of. A lot of people misconstrue that. So what's your take? And can you clearly explain the pros and cons or the sacrifices you make to go with a virtual broker quote?
Yeah. I mean, the broker in general, I think one of the main misconceptions people have is that they see the building, they see the brand as their source of income and credibility. I mean, that's one of the things that they view and see, and they think that that is what you need to have in order to be able to successfully sell real estate. That's a common thought and process, right? So even way back, Coldwell Banker, I think, is like the original realtor brand building agency and teaching people about how to work on behalf of buyers and sellers. They started and they had a place to meet. You know, the way I kind of think about it, this is a real high level thought, but, you know, I heard a quote that said if Keller Williams were to be invented after the internet, then he would have created EXP in that model. Because I think the problem is that they've already gotten themselves so built in, and most big brands have. They feel like they have to have the building, they have to have a place for training, they have to have a place to meet clients. And then
they have to a degree, because part of their income is from bringing agents on and selling them the coaching programs.
Well, and they do. They sell some side benefits.
It's essential.
Well, there's coaching, there is, and then there's office space and computer use and printer fees and all the other expenses they can rack in there. You know, but I realize that, you know, and I talk to agents, I say, okay, I hear you, right? There's that comfort of walking into a space that has a place where you can meet and talk with other people about real estate and build your business. I understand that benefit.
Yeah.
You know, but then I ask, you know, so what, you know, let's identify any client you've ever worked. Have you ever met your client at that office? And inevitably, 99% of them have never met a client at an office.
Where are they meeting them? Are you still having those face-to-face meetings? Or is everything over the phone?
No, everything.
I meet them at showings.
Well, Weston's a good example, right? Yeah. I'm not even really in that part of the market. I'm just talking, and that's the way I see
it. And I've been at the brick and mortar, and I'll be honest, what it did for me, and not to you know, my first broker, Sherry Keeble was at Exit Realty, and she helped me a lot. You know, like that being face-to-face, she made me the office person where I got to review contracts. She did a lot for me. But the downside, I would say, and it is, it does come down to the type of brokerage it was, but there were a lot of people who were more focused on having a side gig as a retirement. Mm-hmm. We had a couple people that were ambitious and, you know, they ended up leaving. But I felt like being in that office, it's not necessarily the office that did this, but it's the environment within the office where those, a lot of those people tend to be stuck in a older mindset that isn't applicable to nowadays, but you just end up being around a lot of people who are more focused on, and there's nothing wrong with it, but just the freedom, the time, the I want something to do, make some money, but you're not necessarily, from where I've been, around a whole lot of people that are trying to just be aggressive and just grow.
We'll talk about that, right? So now you've been with me for about a year.
I've been with you. So I've been the EXP model. I've been 100% with HomeSmart. Yeah. They also had Regis and Spaces. And then I've been with Exit, which was full brick and mortar.
So as far as your training and development and growth for you, where do you feel like you did the most training and development growth?
1,000% with you. Now, I will say...
Hold on before we go there.
Okay.
Because you talked about being in person, training and developing in person with someone, and they gave you opportunities to learn and grow. Mm-hmm. You still felt like, even in our virtual-based business, and I'm not meeting you at my office, so you're learning and growing somehow differently, but you still feel like it's edifying and growing your business.
Yes. Now, what I was going to say is yes, and before I say this, I think that the... Now, I'm looking at overall value. What value am I getting for the $85 a month I spend at EXP? And alone, I've said this before, but KV Core alone is $250 a month, and it's the best CRM I've ever used. Keller Williams, when we say they're in too deep on what they're doing, they're now starting to mimic and model what EXP is doing. Their CRM, from what I've heard, is very similar to KV Core. So they're starting to put that in. But first off, yes, the value that EXP offers when I come over is the money I spend, I get more out of than I did at other places. Now, HomeSmart's fees at the time were like $50 a month, but I didn't get near what I had. Their CRM was like, it was just a joke, you know. Now, what I would say is I had plenty of people calling me to join EXP asking if I've seen the model, and you're the only person I really heard out. So I think that while I came to EXP directly because I like you and where your mind was, and I felt like you were going to help me grow, and this is just, I don't know. Like, I don't know the other side of this. I don't know how much I would like it if I weren't on your team. I think that being on your team specifically has helped me in a way that I don't know that I would get specifically by just joining EXP. But there's a lot of teams with EXP. Sure. So it's, I mean, that's...
You just got to get plugged in the right place, right? Mm-hmm. And I understand that I offer a lot of things to help individual agents, and I like it. I really like that part of it. Mm-hmm. But there are... All the tools are still available whether you're with me or not. They're still there.
Yeah.
But sometimes people have trouble identifying and seeing that. Mm-hmm. So one of the components that we're talking about that people have this misconception is that not having a office means that I'm not going to grow and have success as an agent. And I don't think that's true. I think you're an easy example.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of other reasons why, but that was one thing I wanted to make sure.
And on that specifically, being with you and like the office part doesn't make me successful. Like going to an office, sure, like that doesn't mean that makes zero difference to me. Like you know,
if sometimes in an office, we've got it.
Right? Yeah. And again, like days sure, where I feel like I can't focus because my dog is whining, or, you know what I mean? Like I could just go like, there's certain days where I'll make myself go up to Regis and crank out 100 phone calls, and I just get it done quicker. Cause that's all I can do is just, I got to stay moving. And you know, so,
but the bigger thing that I think that really makes it people not understand because they're so tied into the original view of how real estate is they believe the broker is the source of everything, and they either the brand, the image, or just a broker running a local facility is the way that you have to sell real estate. Mm-hmm. And there's two big problems with both of it, both the office and that the broker and they see them as the source and the brand is, you know, one of the reasons I came over here is I pay nothing for a building and I pay nothing for advertising. There isn't any cost. There's zero cost. It cost me $85 to have a virtual access DXP, just like you said. That's it. $85 a month. I get everything.
Now I got a question. And you're not just an agent. You do a lot more business, but what inclined you? You said you had this office for 8 years. Yeah. So at what point did you feel like you needed a brick and mortar place to go? And not that you bring clients here, but it's just that what was it that made you feel like?
I happen to still retain my office, but I do a lot of synergistic business that's a little outside of traditional real estate doing retail. OK, Okay. I mean, I do a lot of flips. I do a lot of working with developers and people and bringing them together, commercial deals. And me working at home would be consequential. So I'm giving up X number of months for me to be able to continue to do that. And I have one of my business partners meet me up here almost every day. And we stay so in tune in business, and we're doing things well beyond just selling real estate, right?
Yeah.
And that's the reason why I decided to retain it. Plus, I like creating a space that I already have that I can invite people to come and see me.
Yeah.
You know, I meet with a lot of really sharp people, and having a place myself is my own personal benefit. Mm-hmm. The average real estate agent isn't needing that.
Right.
They're not needing that to sell real estate.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, a building will do zero to sell real estate for you.
Yeah.
A building will do nothing for you selling real estate. Nothing.
Yeah.
And the second thing, the broker image, and the whole thing is I do sell a lot of real estate, which allows me to create a lot of leads, which I give away, mm-hmm. right? So I those leads go out. So Weston gets a lead, or one of my other agents gets a lead. They convert it. I'll never hear from them again. So the thought process that lead was created from me, from my own sales to Weston, that lead will never call me again, no matter where Weston goes. You can go work for any other agent out there, and they belong to you.
Yeah.
So that whole relationship is gone. So for me to be the one that creates everything is not true.
Yeah.
You know, agents themselves have the ability to cultivate and work their own leads regardless of the broker.
Yeah.
I promise you, a balloon is not going to sell more real estate for you.
Yeah.
The KW sign is not going to sell more. It's just not.
Yeah.
And they want you to believe that it does. So you pay for something that doesn't actually create that value. Mm-hmm. That's the misconception.
So I'll go into an inherent difference between being just a real estate broker and on the lender side of things. A big position why my own position was created with Wells Fargo to be in the bank, right? To meet those customers that come in to Wells Fargo branches on a day-to-day basis, sure. asking those questions, right? So there's a difference between having that foot traffic coming in and not having that foot traffic coming in as a real estate agent.
Sure.
And I don't think, whereas you're saying,
and I think they get foot traffic. I actually do. I think a KW office will get some foot traffic.
I have something to add. When you're done, I got something mm-hmm. to go in
but,
on.
But even though,
but not the $20,000 a month rent.
Right.
Yeah. So even though you're getting that foot traffic, you still don't think it's worth it to an extent. Whereas,
yeah, there's no ROI in that. Right. There's nobody, no one's walking to it. They want to call you because they see a sign in a yard, or they see a listing on their app. That's 90%+ of people. They're not going to say, oh, I see a house for sale. I better go drive to this Coldwell banker down the street and go in there and then let them go tell me about the house. No, they're looking it all up. They got all the information.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a phone number I can call.
Right.
Why would I drive to an office? That just, it doesn't exist.
Unnecessary.
It's a waste of money.
So I still think there is a consumer preference out there, specifically in, maybe it's in more rural areas. Maybe it's with a little bit of an older demographic where they want to see you face-to-face. They want to have that conversation in person, shake your hand, and look you in the eyes.
You're going to meet them at the house.
And right. Well, so when do you set that appointment? So after you have that phone call.
Wes can answer that. He gets his call all the time.
I have the best. This is like the best example. So I've thought so much about this because when I sold cars, I made, you know, my goal was about 100 cold calls a day, get people in. And no matter how much I did that, a lot of the, you know, I was selling, there were months I sold 21 cars a month. And a big portion of that was always coming from foot traffic. So when I'm sitting at, you know, whether it's Regis, whether it's Regis, it was the foot traffic, honestly, was the majority of what I was doing, right? But what I'm getting at
I'm saying supplemental, the additional work you put in to generate.
Right.
Yeah,
it's right.
Supplemental.
So what I realized, and I need to do more of this, but, you know, a lot of times since selling cars, and I'm thinking about, because at the end of the day, whether it's foot traffic, a lead generation, running Facebook ads, cold calls, it's all a lead source, you know, and you've said this plenty of times, that open house is a Zillow lead face to face. So, you know, mm-hmm. just because you're a virtual brokerage, there's still ways to get that foot traffic by doing open houses. It's not the office. Yep. And even if it is the office, you know, what's going to happen? Okay, cool. Someone walked in and needs a house. Well, there's 30 agents at this Keller Williams that are going to jump on that, and you've got to fight for it. Same way walk-ups came at car sales. That's why people in car sales are like kind of standoffish. It's to say, no, the second someone sees you, they're walking towards you. Because if you don't, there's 10 other car salesmen coming towards you. Same at a brokerage. But when you're running the open house, you're the only only one there. So there's, it's actually a more efficient way to get that foot traffic is to do the open houses, right? You know, so
since we can put all the houses in one lot,
yeah,
then they'll come see.
Yeah,
since we can't, and we have to create it.
Yeah, so and it, you're right, it is for the mortgage industry, that is the only way to get. You can join up with realtors and come do an open house with me any day, right?
The unique thing is that he's in a retail accounting, checking all that, mm-hmm. and they
can come for other reasons 100%. Than just looking just at like, a house. Yeah. It's, you can see, hey, you know.
I'll tell you where there is some unique propositions in the building. It's actually not the rule. It's vacation places, right? Because mm-hmm. you're relaxed. I don't need to get online and answer all my questions. And they all have these suites, and they put all the pictures of all the vacation homes. All these real estate agents do this, or brokerages. And them having that and then posting it, they probably get a good amount of walk-in traffic. Mm-hmm. Just because somebody's there, they're relaxed, they don't have to, they're not in a timeline. I'd be looking at some real estate in here. Let's go in and see what they got available.
Yeah.
That might be an exception to me in general, but we're in a fast-moving, high turnover, Dallas-Fort Worth, and the building is incredibly, outrageously expensive with very little ROI.
Yeah.
I just think that it's an unnecessary expense.
Yeah. And especially too, I mean, again, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but $85 a month to have Regis almost anywhere you go. I mean, yeah. They're in every city. Yeah. You can go to any place and sit down, have the office feel, and you get KV Core with it. You get, mm-hmm. you get mentors, you get coach, you can get whatever you want. And it's like people don't focus on the value they get. They focus on what they're paying and what they're, you know, and the office is a tangible thing that they can experience, but it's not everything. It's not even 25. It's not even like 20%. Like it's just.
So I'd like to open up two conversations kind of based off this. The first one being that talking about how buildings aren't necessary as much anymore. That stems from the pandemic, and the commercial industry has been hit extraordinarily hard. I mean, you're seeing vacancy rates on commercial properties, offices that are higher than they really have been in recent history.
I worked in HR for years, and I'll tell you what's funny leading into that is before all that, you had flex time and things like that, which was encouraging people from working from home because computers, internet, right? Mm-hmm. So that whole trend is really led into this as well. In addition to the pandemic, where they're able to continue to do their same work and not actually come into an office. Can you keep going?
Yeah, absolutely. And so these vacancy rates being as high as they are, we're seeing these massive bonds for these commercial properties in downtowns default across the United States and metros all over the place. And so the question comes up, and we talked about this briefly, but what are these companies and properties going to do? They don't have incentive to pay their rent right now. They're not making the money that they need to on it. I mean, what are the options for these conversions? What do they do to make this space worth it?
Yeah, I talked about this, I think, in a prior podcast. It's funny because Toyota came here, right? And they came here and they built one of their biggest facilities in the U.S. coming, I think, from California, like everybody else. I'm sure they offered them free tax and all kinds of crazy incentives to get them there. But they're there in Frisco, and that building like sits half vacant mm-hmm. since they've been here. They moved in, I think, just before the pandemic. One of my good friends works there, and she works from home 90% of the time. And she does a lot of, she's become incredibly proficient at Zoom and teaches and trains other people in Zoom. In fact, she's critiqued mine and given me a lot of good feedback, which I'm grateful for. So that's been a big transition. So what do they do with the excess space? Well, I see deurbanization for two primary reasons. One is that we have the ability to, and the people say this, my next door neighbor is paying $4,500 a month for a fully furnished house that he came from California and he's going to stay here for a year while he's transitioning because he has no reason to go to the office in California, and they gave him the freedom to move wherever he wanted to move.
Yeah, like, I know so many people like that too. Yeah. Like Austin, Houston, a lot of friends from college.
Lots of people coming from California.
I had buddies that went out to Florida. You know,
Florida's another target place that people go to
he was remote from Austin and he was like, I'm just going to go live in Florida, Airbnb for a month and surf.
Well, both Florida and Texas are huge states. A lot of people are flooding to for a lot of reasons, but
pun intended.
Yeah. But the climate of deurbanization is allowing people to live anywhere. I felt like this may be that resurge of rural. Like people are like, if I had my choice, I don't want a neighbor, you know, 100, you know, 10 feet from me on both sides.
Yeah.
I want a backyard. I want to be able to let my dogs out or my kids play in the front yard. You know, I grew up and I played in the front yard. We didn't lock our doors, and it wasn't that long ago. It was an island village. You know, it's completely safe.
Same indicator. You know,
I wouldn't even dream to do that now in my current house. And we live in a very safe neighborhood. But there's no way I'm letting my kids out front. He's 8. There's no way. I wouldn't even think about it.
Yeah.
So that's a fun thing. The other thing is you have these massive buildings that are getting vacated. You know, I don't know what the future looks like, but it sure makes a lot of sense that we have, you know, the Jetsons, right? Where we live in these tall buildings and we have entire, you know, redesigned, you know, repurposed into massive parks and fully capable of handling all the things you would need.
Yeah,
so grocery stores, everything.
So you're talking living, working, everything. Entertainment, all in within a couple floors of a high rise.
But you can have the retail and the park and everything else associated that you would need as a part of your normal schools.
Right.
We could all be built into these things.
That I feel like that would make people pretty depressed for lack of sunlight.
Yes. It's not that you still can't get out.
They have windows.
But it's, I'd say the convenience.
And I think not to say people are already stuck inside on their phones.
You live in these things for years and you may not leave.
We have enough supply right now in the commercial space to probably last for the next few decades.
Oh, I'm sure.
Just with the way that the pandemic has altered everyone's perceptions of work from home and in office, all these vacancies I think will need to be filled somehow. And I think the most direct, straightforward solution to that is adding more residential capacity and converting these properties.
It's a lower cost in benefit, right? Normally commercial is more expensive per square foot. You can, inexpensively you can make that conversion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I do realistically see that. I think people would be negatively affected by that.
I heard this quote a long time ago, increased technology, decreased morality.
Yeah.
Right. There's this general thought that the easier our life gets, the less that we are in tune with each other. Like social media has increased technology. I don't think that improves our social skills or connecting with other people skills.
So you sacrifice more connections for the better individual connection. So say you can reach out to 10 people online. They don't really know you from a message.
Weaker connection,
Yes, exactly. And I think social media really does push that quantity more so than developing those quality relationships with people.
100%.
And that's a problem, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, 100%.
Certainly.
Well, we're wrapping up on time. Let's get the plugs out of the way. What do y'all got to promote today?
Yeah, go ahead, Mason.
I'm a lender with Wells Fargo Home Mortgage and 3 branches in North Texas, Decatur, Springtown, and Rome. If you do have any questions for home buying needs, you can feel free to give me a call at my cell phone number, which is 940-210-9256. And I'll check you out for any pre-qual, pre-approval, refinance, anything that you need as far as your primary homes, investment properties, that sort of thing.
Sean Corbett, True West Realty Group. I'm a broker owner of that brand, brokered by eXp. And my biggest goal and the thing that I want more than anything is to continue to help other agents grow their business and have success. I spend almost all of my time focused on resolving contracts, getting things closed, and then giving opportunities, and then teaching and training. That's where I spend most of my time.
Yeah. And I can vouch for them. It works. Been there for a little over a year and a half now. So it's been nothing but a good experience there. Me, all I want to do is get this podcast blowing up. So make sure to like, subscribe, share. Logan Paul sucks. Impulsive is a terrible podcast. So is the Full Send podcast. They ask terrible questions. We're the best podcast out there. So just keep supporting it. That's all I got. So peace out. Get you a High Noon or a Duff. You know, so tough. But thanks for watching, and we'll be back next week with another podcast. So peace out.